This is Audible.
Listening Library presents George Washington's Secret Six, The Spies Who Saved America, by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. Read for you by Stephen Graybill. Washington did not really outfight the British. He simply outspied us. Major George Beckwith, British Intelligence Officer, 1782 to 1783. The great objects of information you are very well acquainted with, such as arrivals, embarkations, preparations for movements, alteration of positions, situation of posts, fortifications, garrisons, strength or weakness of each, distribution and strength of corps, and in general, everything which can be interesting and important for us to know. Besides these, you are also sensible there are many things upon a smaller scale which are necessary to be reported, and that whatever intelligence is communicated ought to be, not in general terms, but in detail, and with the greatest precision. General George Washington, in a letter to Benjamin Talmadge, April 1781. A note from the author. Dear reader, there are many reasons why I am flat out thrilled to share this adaptation of George Washington's Secret Six with you. First and foremost, it's important to me that our latest generation of Americans understands how special our first generation was, and how lucky we all are to be part of the American miracle. I know I'm not alone in this hope. The most common refrain I get when I travel and speak about the original book is, "I wish my kids were old enough to read this story." Now there's an illustrated edition of it, just for you. When you were born in the United States, you don't automatically know what makes America great. It's so difficult to be thankful and grateful for something you didn't do anything to earn. But understanding our past will help answer that question. And the story of the Culper spy ring is just the sort of history book I would have loved as a kid. It tells the fast-paced tale of true patriots, showing a time of crisis when our sovereignty and security was threatened. And with so many seemingly impossible victories, you get the sense that perhaps divine intervention played a role in the founding of our nation. Though George Washington lends his name to the title, the true message of this book is not to be more like him or to hold yourself to his standard. Our first president and first general is in a lofty category all his own. Rather, this is the story of so-called average everyday Americans doing extraordinary things, putting their lives at risk for the hope of finding freedom, liberty, and a new country. The five men and one woman who formed the Culper spy ring, farmer Abraham Woodhull, longshoreman Caleb Brewster, tavern owner Austin Rowe, grocer Robert Townsend, printer James Rivington, and female socialite Agent 355, accomplished feats that have even today's CIA in awe. I believe we all can see ourselves in this story, and maybe we won't have to wait for another Marvel Comics movie to find our next superheroes. Real-life superheroes lived, and still live, right here in America. Maybe the next hero is your neighbor, your relative, your friend. Maybe it's you. All combined, we make the United States of America the finest country this world has produced. But unless you study our journey and relive our struggles, you will never truly appreciate it. Enjoy. Brian. Preface. Spring 1775. It could not have been a more exciting time for patriots longing for liberty. On April 19, on the town green in Lexington, Massachusetts, during a skirmish between colonial militiamen and British soldiers, a shot rang out. It was followed shortly after by another confrontation in nearby Concord. That one day would mark an indelible change in the course of history. It serves as the date on which to pin the beginning of the War of Independence. In 1837, it got its slogan, "The Shot Heard Round the World," when Ralph Waldo Emerson published a poem called Concord Hymn. Part of it reads, "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. The colonists were soon to experience the true cost of war. On June 17, 1775, on a hill outside of Boston, the ragtag colonial forces battered the British. But the Battle of Bunker Hill cost them heavy losses in life and limb for only a modest gain in land. The delegates from the colonies to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia knew that their forces could not withstand this kind of loss for long. Eventually, they would run out of people ready to fight. The delegates urgently needed to prepare for a full-scale war. Among the representatives from Virginia was the tall, soft-spoken surveyor, farmer, and former spy, widely regarded for his valor in battle and exemplary leadership in the militia during the previous war, George Washington. That he was highly thought of is clear in this section of a letter John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail. I can now inform you that the Congress have made choice of the modest and virtuous, the amiable, generous, and brave George Washington, Esquire, to be the general of the American army, and that he is to repair as soon as possible to the camp before Boston. It is also clear that Washington did not seek this task. The day after he was commissioned, he wrote to his wife Martha, whom he called Patsy. It has been determined in Congress that the whole army raised for the defense of the American cause shall be put under my care, and that it is necessary for me to proceed immediately to Boston to take upon me the command of it. You may believe me, my dear Patsy, when I assure you in the most solemn manner that, so far from seeking this appointment, I have used every endeavor in my power to avoid it. Washington was a wise choice. What he lacked in soldiers and supplies, he made up for in intelligence, and his experience as a spy was to come in very handy in a short time. George Washington's Army. George Washington had nerves of steel. He had led thousands of troops into battle, riding tall and calmly through even the heaviest fighting. Myths had grown up around the general. A few people said he was favored by God, that no arrows or bullets could harm him. Of course, he was not actually untouchable, but he was regarded by his peers as a sober-minded man of vision, wisdom, humility, and experience. For these reasons, Washington was asked to serve as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, also known as the Patriots, in their struggle to win independence from English rule. But Washington knew that even substantial numbers of troops meant little without proper training and equipment, and his men lacked both. Washington had the utmost confidence in his officers, but to say that the rest of the Continental Army was rough around the edges would be an understatement. City men who had never held a rifle stood with country folk who had never had a day of formal schooling. Hardy farmers struggled to cooperate with young men of landed wealth, who had never known a moment of discomfort or hunger in their lives. Old men lined up with boys who had lied about their age to join up in pursuit of adventure. They came from all over the country, from as far north as the mountains of New England and as far south as the swamps of Georgia. Many of Washington's men had never been more than 50 miles from the place of their birth, let alone met anyone with such a strange accent as could be found in the hills of Virginia or the English settlements of Massachusetts. They were all on the side of liberty, but there the unity ended. Despite the makeup of the army, it had enjoyed an early moral victory at Bunker Hill. The end of the siege of Boston in March 1776, after almost a year, was also a win for the Patriots. But their success was due more to the position and strength of the American fortifications than to any great offensive maneuvers to rout the enemy. The British gave up on the city, leaving voluntarily rather than fleeing in an all-out retreat. General William Howe, then commander-in-chief of the British Army in North America, had his sights set on a much bigger and more agreeable prize than belligerent Boston, the great port city of New York. Although Washington knew he had the hearts of his men and that most were brave, loyal, and passionate about their liberty, He did not know whether that passion could hold New York against the thousands of well-trained British forces decked out in their red-coated uniforms. The few American troops still holding New York's Manhattan Island in 1776 were hanging on by a thread, and Washington was desperate to strengthen their position. To do so, he formulated a plan. He needed to recruit a spy to collect information on British plans. Espionage was not a new activity to Washington. He had served as a spy during the French and Indian War and knew how important it was to have advance information. At this stage in the war, with the troops he had, it was his only hope. Washington saw that the Patriots would need to outmaneuver the British. They could not overpower them. The British Army and Navy boasted superior numbers, training, supplies, and equipment, and there was little hope of defeating their forces in head-to-head combat, unless their battle plans and their weaknesses were already known. By learning the enemy's secrets, spies would play a crucial role in undermining British attacks, allowing the Continental Army to anticipate the Redcoats' next moves. Part 1. Chapter 1. Why New York? Holding New York was the cornerstone in Washington's strategy to win the war. The vast area included two islands, Staten Island and Manhattan Island, the western end of Long Island, and the territory north of Manhattan along the Hudson River. As the second most populous city in the colonies after Philadelphia, New York was an economic hub in the north. But even more significant were New York's location and situation. Right in the center of Britain's North American settlements, with a large deep water harbor and access to the Hudson River. The army that held New York City and its waterways had a strategic advantage not only in controlling the import and export of foodstuffs and dry goods, but also in securing a key foothold for transporting troops up and down the coast. Maintaining control of New York City and New York Harbor would give the American soldiers and the Patriot populace a tremendous boost in confidence, and it would certainly be an embarrassment to the British Army and Navy, and to the many loyalist citizens of New York. However, the British could survive such a blow. For the Americans, losing the region would be a tragedy, destroying morale, cutting off trade, and drastically lowering the odds that the Patriots could win the war. Chapter 2. On the March. On April 4, 1776, Washington set out from his headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As he marched south, he must have nursed the hope that the Continental Army's muscle and moxie would be enough to outfight the British and hold Manhattan. Being a seasoned fighter and a brilliant strategist, he understood, perhaps better than anyone else in North America, that control of New York City was essential for the cause of liberty, and that keeping the city would be a daunting task. 10 days later, Washington and his men arrived in Manhattan. Washington established his headquarters in a mansion. His men, 10,000 strong, slept where they could. That summer, news arrived that both cheered and sobered them all. 56 delegates from the colonies had convened in the midst of stifling July heat in Philadelphia to form the Second Continental Congress and had written and signed the Declaration of Independence, which stated that the 13 colonies sought to separate from England and become self-governing. If ever there was a point of no return, this was it. The British, meanwhile, were amassing troops that would be 20,000 strong on undefended Staten Island, with 30,000 more on ships looming in New York Harbor. As August dragged on, tensions mounted. A copy of the Declaration of Independence had been put before the crown, which meant that King George III finally understood the seriousness of the colonists' determination to fight. No longer would King George order his generals to show restraint in their efforts to squelch the rebels, or maintain that a mere show of force would be enough to subdue the revolution. He would not show mercy. Of this, Washington felt sure. Chapter 3. Betrayal at Jamaica Pass. The first battle in the New York area was swift and devastating, tipped off, perhaps by a spy within Washington's own ranks or by a loyalist, that Jamaica Pass in Long Island was guarded by only 5 men. The British set out in that direction. The pass was part of a hilly, heavily wooded area that protected Brooklyn from attacks from the south. William Howard Jr., a young patriot who ran a tavern with his father near Jamaica Pass, woke about 2 hours after midnight on the morning of August 27 to a British soldier standing beside his bed. The soldier ordered him to get up, dress, and go downstairs. He quickly obeyed and found his father cornered by 3 redcoats pointing their muskets with fixed bayonets at him. A glance out the window revealed that a whole fighting unit stood at the ready. General Howe himself waited for the 2 men in the barroom. "I must have some one of you to show me over the Rockaway path around the pass," he remarked, setting down his empty glass. "We belong to the other side, General," the father replied, "and can't serve you against our duty." Howe's reply was kind but curt. "That is all very well. Stick to your country or stick to your principles when you are free to do so. But tonight, Howard, you are my prisoner and must guide my men over the hill." The senior Howard began to protest, but Howe cut him off. "You have no alternative. If you refuse, you will be shot." The Howards directed General Howe up the winding footpath. Behind them marched 10,000 men, arriving at the other side in time to attack the Patriot General Nathan Woodhull and his men. As the battle continued throughout the day, Washington recognized his miscalculation. The full contingent of British troops would not storm Manhattan. The Redcoats were bringing heavy force to bear on Brooklyn, too. Washington shifted more men and supplies to Brooklyn, but it was too late for the Americans to recover and hold their ground. By day's end, Brooklyn and the surrounding area were largely in British hands, with the retreating Patriots trapped in Brooklyn Heights. Manhattan was still held by the Continental Army, but Washington was sure it was only a matter of time until the British overtook it, too. Washington's troops suffered a major blow. The Americans had lost more than 300 men that day, in addition to nearly 700 wounded and 1,000 captured. The British and their hired German mercenaries, called Hessians, had lost a mere 64 men, with 31 reported as missing and 293 wounded. Chapter 4. A Miracle in the Mist. Things could not have gone worse for the Continental Army, and it wasn't over, though the cannons had ceased firing for now. The fighting had taken Washington across the East River, and now he was essentially trapped in Brooklyn Heights, surrounded by the British and with no way to escape. If his troops pursued a retreat by land, they would walk directly into the British camps and either be shot on sight or captured and hanged for treason. If they took to the water to escape to Patriot-held Manhattan, they would be sitting ducks as the British fired cannonballs into their rowboats. Just like that, the revolution was all but over. Washington must have reeled at the turn of events. Maybe it was inevitable. After all, who were the colonists to think they had a chance against the mighty King of England and an empire that encircled the globe? The Americans needed to get out and get out fast. Unless Washington could somehow ferry 9,000 men undetected across New York Harbor, currently patrolled by the might of the Royal Navy, he would be forced to surrender or ask his men to die in a siege from which there was no foreseeable escape. As night fell on the evening of August 29, Washington peered over New York Harbor and knew he had no other hope. Escape by water was the only chance, and even that would take a miracle. Ordering a hasty retreat, Washington oversaw the efforts to ferry his army and their possessions, every man, beast, cannon, and rifle, safely across the water under the cover of darkness. To his relief, the British sentinels failed to spot the shadowy silhouettes of the escaping soldiers. But as the sky began to lighten, there were still many men to move. Miraculously, a thick fog began to roll in, providing cover until every last soldier, animal, and piece of equipment reached safety on the other side. Washington's boots were the last to leave the Brooklyn Heights side of the harbor and the last to alight in Manhattan. By the time the fog lifted and the British realized what had happened, the Americans were already out of the reach of British cannons. They were down, but not out. Washington knew it would be only a matter of days before General Howe ordered an attack on the remaining American fortifications in Manhattan, and that Manhattan would surely fall. Moving north to Connecticut, Washington and his men rejoiced at their escape, though the all but complete loss of New York was a serious blow. Gone was the optimism created by the Boston victory. Troop morale was low. Backed into a corner, Washington now realized what every small, wily boy comes to recognize when faced with the brute strength of a schoolyard bully. He could not defeat his foe with manpower, arms, or any other show of force. He would have to beat the British in a battle of wits. Part 2. Chapter 5. A Change in Strategy. As if the loss of most of New York wasn't bad enough, Washington's autumn was about to get worse. While the defeat at the Battle of Brooklyn had been a blow, the retreat had gone better than planned. Washington's next endeavor would not be so fortunate, ending instead in disaster. As he watched the British secure New York and received reports about the state of his army, Washington knew that his best hope was to outspy the enemy. Unfortunately for the rough-hewn Patriot Army, spying required far more accuracy and delicacy than simply aiming a cannon, and it also took more time. Unlike waging a traditional battle, wherein two armies took a field and fired at each other for several hours or days until one side declared victory, gathering useful intelligence might take weeks or months before combat even began. Developing the sophistication and buying the time necessary to grow an effective spy ring would be difficult, especially in the locations where it mattered most. Recognizing the difficulty of setting up a good espionage network, Washington shifted his wartime strategy from relying on non-existent combat strength to placing his trust in intelligence gathering, even before the catastrophic loss of New York was complete. To begin, he needed one good man. Chapter 6. One Good Man. The general needed a man to venture behind enemy lines disguised as a loyalist. This man would make casual inquiries about troop movements and supply stores and send reports back to Washington. His work would inform the general's plans to take back New York City, its harbor, and the neighboring areas. As the need for information became clear, Washington had asked Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Knowlton, a veteran of many battles and infiltrations, to assemble a select group of officers. On August 12, 1776, Knowlton met with the candidates to inform them of the need. Each was brave, each was trustworthy, and each was silent as Knowlton asked for a volunteer. Finally, 21-year-old Nathan Hale stepped forward. Hale had recently been given a lieutenant's commission by the Connecticut General Assembly. He was an amateur soldier, having taken part only in minor skirmishes. He was a teacher, an actor, and a passionate patriot. And he was available right away. Chapter 7. on assignment. Washington immediately approved Hale's assignment. On September 12, the young man was ferried across the water from Stamford, Connecticut, to largely loyalist Long Island. He would pose as a schoolmaster looking for work, a cover that would give him an excuse to meet leading townsmen and ask questions about the area. But the move was too late. As September advanced, so had the British troops, capturing the lower end of Manhattan on September 15, just 3 days after Hale landed on Long Island. The defeat had been inevitable, and Washington was prepared for the blow, but the timing could not have been worse. Hale had little chance to establish his identity, let alone transmit any helpful intelligence to Washington before the attack came on Manhattan. Now, every observation of British troop and supply movements would help Washington determine how to take back all of Manhattan, not simply defend their last stronghold on it. Hale was behind enemy lines. Any number of innocent situations could blow his cover to a suspicious local. An ignorance of the proximity of one town to the next, the mispronunciation of a word peculiar to that region, a slip of the tongue that would betray him as a mainlander. Washington felt keenly the responsibility for Hale's safety, having had the final say on whether the mission would go forward. There was no way of knowing how the young man was coping, and this concerned Washington even more. Where was he staying? With whom was he speaking? Had he stumbled into any situations that might put him in harm's way? Just as much as he craved the information Hale would be sending, Washington wanted assurance that the young lieutenant had maintained his cover and could quietly exit Long Island when the right moment came. By the time Hale landed, the island was full of redcoats, armed and itching for a fight with anyone who had even a whiff of patriot sentiments about him. But just as potentially damning to Hale's mission was the civilian population. While there were a few patriots, the sympathies of most Long Islanders lay with King George. Even if a farmer was a patriot, but a British military officer was living in his house, he was very likely to shout "God save the King" if it kept his children safe and his fields unscathed. For this reason alone, Washington worried that a seemingly trustworthy contact might be tempted to report a suspected spy. Hale's flimsy cover story might easily be blown. After all, what school would be looking for a teacher this far into September? Or maybe Hale's own patriotic zeal would do him in, were he unable to remain silent in the face of insults to his cause or to resist sharing his true feelings with someone pretending to be a sympathetic ear. A week passed with no disaster, and Washington breathed a sigh of relief. While the danger was still intense, he hoped Hale had established a solid cover and was out of direct suspicion. Unfortunately, his relief was premature. Chapter 8. Failure on Long Island. On September 21, 1776, Washington spent most of the day studying maps and potential battle plans and, in the evening, writing a few letters. He had no way of knowing that at the tip of Manhattan, Nathan Hale was at that very moment being arrested, charged with spying, and sentenced to be hanged by the neck until dead the following morning. As if to highlight Hale's lonely experience on Long Island, no one can say with certainty exactly where he was detected and captured, or even what activities he was engaged in before that fateful event. Somehow he made his way westward to Brooklyn, then crossed over into Lower Manhattan, though no records show when or how. Perhaps he only made that crossing later, as a prisoner. By some reports, he was recognized by Loyalist cousins and reported to the British. By others, he mistook a British boat for the ferry sent to return him to safety. By still others, he was lulled into a false sense of safety and shared the details of his plans with some loyalist locals at a tavern, and they turned him in. Whatever the case, he was captured, tried, and hanged, all in the span of roughly 12 hours. Shortly after Hale's body ceased to swing, Captain John Montresor of His Majesty's Army set out for the American camp under a flag of truce. He was granted an audience with a young Patriot captain and aide to General Washington named Alexander Hamilton. Montresor informed the Americans of the execution of Lieutenant Hale. The visit was not only a formal courtesy, but also a thinly veiled warning that their sad little attempt at espionage had been an embarrassing failure. The news cut Washington deeply. Hale's death was a tragedy for its own sake, and for the fact that Washington now had no agent to feed him the information he desperately needed from Long Island. But while Hale's attempt to gather and convey intelligence had been an utter failure, he had given his general something valuable, the recognition that Washington needed more than just one brave man on Long Island. He needed an entire network. Chapter 9. The March to New Jersey. As the autumn of 1776 progressed to winter, General George Washington found himself marching from New York to New Jersey to Pennsylvania in a series of disheartening campaigns. His troops were demoralized and the civilian population even more so. Many who were formerly enthusiastic supporters of the Patriot cause swore allegiance to the king or else quietly withdrew their support for liberty. In October, Washington met up with reinforcements, but found their number a mere half of the 5,000 troops he had anticipated. Supplies were low, and he could no longer count on the local populace to show their support by selling food and other necessary supplies to the Continental Army. The British troops, on the other hand, were well supplied, and their numbers were bolstered by the Hessians, German mercenaries with a reputation for being tough and unflappable in battle. Just before the celebration of Christmas, Washington was eyeing a return to New Jersey. He had to regain control of the mid-Atlantic after the disappointing autumn, or he would lose the war. So he began to formulate a plan to attack the Hessian encampment at Trenton, a daring raid requiring yet another treacherous ferrying of men and supplies across water. Braving large masses of ice and winter winds that could easily overturn the small boats, his men would cross the Delaware River and capture the city in an attempt to break a stronghold of British control in the region. Washington was cautiously optimistic that another miracle like the fog over New York Harbor would come to his aid, because Washington had a secret. Chapter 10. There will be no attack. One evening, John Honeyman, a Scots-Irish immigrant who worked in Trenton as a butcher and a weaver, supposedly wandered too close to the Continental Army encampment. He was captured and interviewed by George Washington himself. Honeyman escaped and returned to Trenton, where he made it known to a Hessian colonel that he had inside information. When the colonel asked if Washington's army looked ready to attack that night, Honeyman said no. The Hessians, now free to celebrate Christmas Eve, began to relax and eat and drink liberally. Meanwhile, Honeyman quickly and quietly gathered his family and retreated eastward to New Brunswick, New Jersey, and Washington prepared to strike. It had all been a beautifully orchestrated setup from Honeyman's position in Trenton to his capture, escape, and meeting with the Hessian colonel. Honeyman was Washington's man. Learning from Hale's death, the general had reached out to Honeyman earlier that fall, counting on his outstanding credentials from the French and Indian War, unshakable bravery, and unsuspicious occupation to enable him to operate undetected. Sure enough, Honeyman casually questioned and carefully counted the men about the city and offered a full report back to Washington. Washington asked his agent to plant the false story in the colonel's ear before spiriting himself and his family out of harm's way. "There will be no attack," Honeyman told a Hessian colonel. "The American troops are so disheartened and so bedraggled, they have no plans of advancing anytime soon." It was a perfect plan that went off without a hitch. Honeyman played his part beautifully, and the Hessian troops, all fighting massive hangovers from their raucous Christmas revelries, were caught completely off guard when the Patriots launched their attack in the early hours of December 26. The victory was swift, decisive, and crucial for the American cause. Washington's espionage success further buoyed him and the troops, but the loss of Long Island and Manhattan still weighed heavily on the general's mind. He didn't think the war could be won without recapturing them, and like Trenton, they could not be taken without good, reliable intelligence. Honeyman's efforts at Trenton had proved the value of a well-placed spy and taught Washington two good lessons. His spies would have to blend in as Honeyman had and Hale had not, and they would have to be absolutely convincing in their roles. Washington would need a collection of agents, a ring of men and women with unquestionable fidelity and ordinary identities. He didn't want anyone who stood out. Washington's immediate task would be to enlist two key individuals. First, an officer familiar with the territory and well acquainted with the local families and customs, who could orchestrate the whole enterprise but remain close to Washington's side. And second, an agent on the ground who could recruit the other members, preferably a person who was well connected but had largely kept his political opinions to himself throughout the conflict. A man who would not raise suspicions, but who would rather die than surrender his liberties. Chapter 11. A Waiting Game. As 1777 led to 1778, George Washington's focus was, by necessity, pulled away from New York. Despite a devastating winter at Valley Forge, the Americans were no longer fighting alone, scraping out victories from sheer luck and pluck. Benjamin Franklin's negotiations in France had finally culminated in King Louis XVI's commitment to support the American cause. The Patriots had a well-equipped ally, although it would be many months before ships and troops arrived. By June 1778, orders were issued for the British Army in Philadelphia to abandon the city and set their sights on strengthening their all-important hold on New York. Washington and his men prepared to follow suit, packing up the ragtag army to leave Valley Forge. The logistics of moving an army were all-consuming, but Washington was preoccupied with an even more important task. The time had come to focus his full attention on forming his spy network, and nothing would distract him now. Chapter 12. The Brilliant Young Major, Benjamin Talmadge. Washington needed someone who knew not only the city of New York and the various routes into and out of it, but also enough trusted locals to recruit as spies. The candidate would also need to be nearly inexhaustible if he were to devote the time, strategy, and energy necessary to make the ring successful. Fortunately for Washington, one of the rising young stars of the Continental Army fit the bill exactly. Benjamin Talmadge, a gallant young major from Setauket on Long Island, was still rather green, but his keenness of mind was apparent to everyone who met him, and he knew how to earn the respect and faith of his men, despite the occasional misstep. Besides, his demonstrated courage, his imagination, and most important, his background made him the perfect candidate. Major Benjamin Talmadge of the 2nd Continental Light Dragoons was once thought to be a rather unlikely military man. The son and grandson of ministers, young Benjamin seemed destined for the pulpit rather than the trenches. He knew Nathan Hale in college and, like him, took part in theatricals there. The position of superintendent of the high school in Wethersfield, Connecticut, was offered to him after college, and Talmadge seized the opportunity to share his enthusiasm for study with a younger generation. There he served faithfully for 3 years, though his ambitions drew him toward the legal profession, and he began to seriously consider studying law. But in the spring of 1775, the shot heard round the world rang out at Lexington, Massachusetts, followed by a skirmish at Concord a few hours later. Benjamin Talmadge, like many young men of his time, was swept up in patriotic fervor as the War of Independence officially began. Benjamin talked to friends who had been involved in the combat, and their stories of heroism and zeal began to shift Talmadge's goal from fighting injustice in the courtroom to fighting tyranny on the battlefield. In 1776, when the Second Continental Congress gave approval for the colonies to actively expand their fighting brigades, Talmadge took his leave of the high school at the end of the term and officially became a member of the Connecticut Continental Line on June 20. Now a commissioned officer, Lieutenant Talmadge distinguished himself with his boundless energy and uncanny knack for winning people over, but the art of war didn't come easily to the new recruit. With August came the fateful Battle of Brooklyn and the betrayal at Jamaica Pass. The battle was Talmadge's first taste of war, and it shook him. This was the first time in my life that I had witnessed the awful scene of a battle, when man was engaged to destroy his fellow man, Talmadge wrote more than 50 years later. I well remember my sensations on the occasion, for they were solemn beyond description, and very hardly could I bring my mind to be willing to attempt the life of a fellow creature. In mid-December 1776, Benjamin Talmadge was promoted to captain of the 2nd Continental Light Dragoons by General George Washington himself, who had admired the young man's abilities and conduct, not to mention his loyalty. The appointment was signed in the unmistakable hand of John Hancock, and Talmadge accepted it willingly. He devoted the first third of 1777 to training men and horses for scouting missions and light raids ahead of the more heavily armed cavalry and artillery brigades. During the brutal winter of 1777, and into January 1778, Talmadge stayed close to George Washington at Valley Forge. In such cramped and miserable quarters, the young officer impressed his commander. He was still somewhat untested and not always as far-sighted as more seasoned officers, but both his input and his unsinkable enthusiasm were valued by both subordinates and superiors. When Washington tapped him to act as spymaster on Long Island, Talmadge acted quickly. He knew right away whom he would approach to be his man on the ground. Chapter 13. The Black Sheep, Abraham Woodall. Growing up, Abraham Woodall was a neighbor of Benjamin Talmadge's, and he shared many of the young officer's ideals. But that's where their resemblance ended. Woodall was not a bright-eyed, optimistic, jolly young man-turned-soldier like Talmadge. He agreed with the desire for liberty, but he wanted so badly to be personally independent that he avoided official military service because he would have been subject to the orders of superiors. Abraham was his parents' third son, raised in a prominent and celebrated family, while his older brothers, Richard V and Adam, were groomed to step into the role of American gentlemen and succeed their father. Young Abraham was released to the freedom of the outdoors. He neither minded nor resented his lot in life, especially since he found schoolwork hard and boring. While his brothers were laboring over passages of classical literature, Abraham explored the landscape of Long Island. The Woodhull girls, Susanna and Mary, doted on their baby brother, and Abraham was equally fond of them. When Mary married Amos Underhill and moved with him to Manhattan, Abraham made a habit of visiting them. Sometimes he traveled by land across Long Island, and then by boat across the East River to Manhattan. Other times he caught a ride with a longshoreman rowing across Long Island Sound to Connecticut, and then traveled southward over land to the city. He enjoyed these trips, but he was not free for long. In 1768, at the age of 21, Adam died. 6 years later, at the age of 30, Richard V died. And so, in 1774, Abraham found himself suddenly and unexpectedly in position to inherit the Woodhull family's homestead. It was a windfall he had neither hoped for when it was out of reach, nor welcomed now that it was his. He had never considered himself cut from the same fabric as the rest of the prominent landowners in his father's circle, and had gone to some pains not to adopt their upright and uptight behavior. Abraham Woodhull was proud of being the black sheep of his straight-laced family, and so he assumed the burden of familial duty with reluctance. Chapter 14. Setting Up Aliases. How Talmadge and Woodhull reconnected and developed the first phase of their plan is not exactly clear. It is almost certain that Talmadge arranged to meet his old neighbor and family friend in Connecticut, as the risk of setting foot in occupied New York City or Long Island would have been too great. Most of Connecticut was still solidly in American hands in August 1778, providing a good meeting place for the two men. Woodhull was appealing as a recruit because Talmadge knew that he could be trusted, that he was a skilled judge of character and would enlist the aid of good men, and that he was a patriot. Talmadge informed Woodhull of his charge from Washington. He was to install a ring of spies to convey information from Manhattan, either directly by land, over the border to Connecticut, or, perhaps more safely, across the Sound from Long Island, and from there to the more rural areas of Connecticut, much farther from British inspectors who might possibly intercept the intelligence. Talmadge, who was based in Connecticut, would receive and analyze the sensitive information before spiriting it away to wherever Washington happened to be encamped at the time, which was almost always within just a few days' ride of New York City. Talmadge wanted Woodhull to find the spies from among his community on Long Island because they were the people who knew the land, the water, and the local customs. Woodhull agreed. A few days later, Talmadge met with Washington in White Plains, New York. Of utmost importance to both was the creation of pseudonyms. The stakes were far too high for Talmadge and Woodhull to use their real names in any kind of correspondence. In Talmadge's case, an intercepted letter would make him an even higher value target should the British learn he was now a spy. In Woodhull's case, living in the midst of the enemy, identification meant immediate arrest, likely followed by a trip to the gallows. The general and the major discussed the best approach to the assignment of names, at once specific enough to be clearly and instantly identifiable to the intended recipient, yet not so unusual as to be obviously fake, nor so common that an innocent individual who happened to bear the same name might be hunted down by the enemy. Thus, Talmadge was dubbed John Bolton, using one of the oldest surnames in the colonies. The origin of Woodhull's name was a little more creative. Talmadge selected Samuel for a first name, probably in honor of his younger brother, Samuel Talmadge, who had done some courier work for patriot efforts on Long Island. The last name, it has been suggested, was an adaptation of Culpeper, a county in Virginia near Washington's boyhood home. Thus, Samuel Culper was born. The pseudonyms were in place, courier routes were set, specifics as to the type of information Washington sought were established. The groundwork was laid for the ring to begin its work. The first two cogs, Talmadge and Woodhull, could now begin turning the wheel that would steadily roll out the defeat of the British in New York. They would not disappear into their new identities and leave their old lives behind. Instead, their spy names would serve as their passports into a double life, with Talmadge as an intelligence officer with a closely guarded secret and a covert post in Connecticut where he would retrieve the latest news, and Woodhull as a man who must go unnoticed in the den while seeking ways to overthrow the lions. Chapter 15. A Bull of a Man, Caleb Brewster. Woodhull had his sights set on Caleb Brewster as a fellow spy from the beginning. Brewster was also from Long Island and had signed a statement saying he would support the Patriots. As a longshoreman, he was a bull of a man, physically huge and imposing from his work of loading and unloading cargo from ships. Recently, he had taken to using his intimidating size and tremendous athletic skill to make himself a regular nuisance to the British. Ever the daredevil, he taunted them from his boat, laden with smuggled goods, and then amazingly evaded capture. Just as Woodhull knew the landscape, Brewster knew the coves and the waterways of Long Island Sound, slipping out of reach of the British by ducking into one or another until the patrol gave up trying to catch him. What Woodhull did not know was that Brewster had already embraced the thrill of espionage. The young man had been in correspondence with General Washington since July 1778, several weeks before Talmadge had recruited Woodhull to manage the ring, reporting on the state of the British warships in New York Harbor, as well as on troop movements and naval preparations around Long Island. His reports revealed little new information and were somewhat out of date by the time they reached Washington, but the gesture proved to the commander-in-chief that there were patriots ready and willing to spy, and that a well-organized ring of secret agents could yield real intelligence. While taking care not to be overheard, Woodhull was probably rather direct in his proposal to Brewster. The youth's vigor and fearlessness in openly defying the British Navy on the Sound left little doubt where his sentiments lay. Already hooked on the adrenaline rush of espionage, Brewster was an easy sell. He enthusiastically agreed to ferry messages to Connecticut and even offered to add his own observations to the reports headed to Talmadge. Chapter 16. The Tavern Keeper, Austin Rowe. Woodhull supposed that his old friend, Austin Rowe, might prove more difficult to recruit. But Rowe could provide one essential element to the group. He owned a tavern in East Setauket on Long Island that was patronized by British soldiers and other people loyal to the king. Rowe was friends with Brewster, both jovial and spirited. In addition, Rowe was comfortably situated, married, and firmly established in his business, and he didn't seem to have the daredevil streak that Brewster had. He couldn't afford it. His livelihood was entirely dependent upon the loyal patronage of local folks, many of them loyalists, and the occasional traveler who passed his way and needed a room for the night. His work made overhearing enemy conversations an easy task. However, because he was in the public eye, he had to be especially careful. Suspicions have a way of becoming whispers in small towns, and rumors about Rowe's activities could hurt his business even after the war. Of course, should the spy's work be discovered, they could all expect something far worse than a loss of employment. Despite initial concerns, Rowe was pleased by the mission and eager to offer his service in any way he could. Chapter 17. Breaking from tradition, a new way to work a spy ring. Now a team of three, Woodhull, Brewster, and Rowe, devised a plan by which their intelligence would crisscross its way over land and water to reach General Washington. Woodhull would operate from his brother-in-law Amos Underhill's boarding house in Manhattan, a location unlikely to arouse suspicion because he already made fairly regular visits. The information he gathered would leave the city in one of two ways. Either Rowe would make the trip into the city on the pretense of purchasing supplies for his tavern, or Woodhull himself would travel back to Setauket, where he would leave the papers at Rowe's tavern or a predetermined location in a field near Rowe's house. This dead-drop method was less likely to raise suspicions, but presented a much higher risk of a stranger's stumbling upon the papers before they had been picked up, so the men rarely employed it. The Woodhull and Rowe families were known to be old friends. Rowe's father had purchased the building he used for his home and business from the Woodhulls back in 1759, so nothing would seem out of place, even if the two men were seen together carrying letters for the folks at home or visiting in the city. But Rowe and Woodhull took care to ensure that the patterns of their meetings would not become too predictable and therefore seem shady to nosy locals or eagle-eyed British soldiers. Caleb Brewster, whose family lived just yards away from Rowe, would wait for an opportunity to retrieve the papers from Rowe. He would then row across Long Island Sound when the British Navy had their backs turned. On the Connecticut side of the Sound, Talmadge would be waiting for Brewster to dock and pass off the letters, which Talmadge would then hand-deliver to the general. The whole process usually took approximately 2 weeks from beginning to end. The plan offered important advantages over the more traditional method of a single spy slipping in to gather intelligence and then slipping back out again. Local people were less likely to raise suspicions than an outsider who suddenly appeared in the town, skulked about for a few days, and then disappeared again. The intermediate step of entrusting the papers to Rowe was a brilliant one. It minimized the connection between Woodhull's frequent trips to the city, as well as his extended stays there, and Brewster's regular dashes across the water, and it allowed the men to avoid apparent contact. The proximity of Brewster's home to Rowe's made their familiarity far more natural. Chapter 18. The Reports Begin. Almost immediately, Woodhull revealed himself to be a remarkably careful observer, detailing where British troops were situated and how strong their positions were, but he was also an extremely nervous operative. On November 23, 1778, Woodhull, as Culper, wrote to General Washington with a precise count of troops at various towns on Long Island, as well as a request for reimbursement for his expenses. Washington was impressed with the detailed information he received and spoke with Talmadge about arranging a face-to-face meeting with his brave new ringleader, a suggestion that rattled Woodhull no small amount. He thought he had made it abundantly clear to Talmadge that he did not want his association with spying activities to be openly acknowledged in any public way. Of course, the general knew about the ring, but Woodhull felt that his personal appearance before Washington was unnecessary and would raise questions. The proposed meeting was abandoned, but Woodhull remained nervous. His agitation was not improved by a slight adjustment made to the delivery route just 5 weeks later, in January 1779. Instead of Talmadge personally delivering the letters to General Washington's hand, he was now going to pass them off to General Israel Putnam, who would then carry them and other dispatches from Danbury, Connecticut, to wherever the commander-in-chief was encamped at the time. Even though Putnam, a hero of Bunker Hill, knew nothing of the true identity of Culper, it was nerve-wracking for Woodhull, who feared any involvement of strangers. Austin Rowe also made a move that rankled Woodhull even further. He hired a young man named Jonas Hawkins as an occasional courier, both to dilute suspicion and to get information into Talmadge's hands more quickly, because Hawkins could carry information at times when Rowe's business prevented him from traveling. Even if Hawkins was not privy to the full extent of the operation, another person now knew at least part of the secret, and this worried Woodhull. But the changes halved the amount of time it took for Woodhull's intelligence to reach Washington, from 2 weeks to only one. Woodhull couldn't argue against the improvement. Despite his fraying nerves, Woodhull persisted with his meticulous scouting reports. Caleb Brewster supplemented the reports with his own reporting on shipbuilding activities and the particular ships in each Long Island inlet and harbor. Together, these reports began to create a rich and detailed picture of New York's defenses, as well as providing important clues about the enemy's future strategy. Chapter 19 The Unbreakable Code.